The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. No mai, hoki mai, kia The Fold, e mihi nei, ko Duncan Greer, tōku ingoa. I'm about to do a monopod, you know, I do them periodically when there's a lot going on. Wild thing is that I'm actually re-recording. I did one of these, I'm recording this Friday morning, the 23rd of September. Yesterday morning I recorded this first segment and it was about the merger, about the state of it, about the draft bill that's before Parliament, and it was basically saying there's a lot that could happen, but we don't know. Honestly, like 2 hours after I finished recording, the whole thing blew up and there's been three massive developments. Well, two massive developments and one small petty thing, which I think is actually quite funny. So I'm going to just redo the whole thing. Then after that, I talk about the state of social media, the kind of the big changes that Facebook is doing in the face of the growth of TikTok in particular. And then finally, a little bit about the Queen and the kind of saturation media coverage of that and some sense of like, I understand why the mainstream media went so big on it, but I also think there might have been something a little bit sort of self-destructive in the medium term about that. And I've tried to kind of segue all these things together because I do think there's a through line. Anyway, first up, I'm going to talk about the state of the merger. So where we're at right now is that the bill that merges TVNZ and RNZ is before Parliament. It's called the Aotearoa New Zealand Public Media Bill. That is meant to be a sort of a placeholder name for the new organisation, but I think it's actually going to end up being what it's called. If you listened last week, you'll have heard Simon Power, the newish CEO of TVNZ, talking about how they're broadly supportive of the bill, but there are a few issues that they have. Or they're supportive of the idea. And the interesting thing about that is that has been his public line, but there's been this kind of rumor that's kind of drumming around that while that's the public line, that the nature of the issues that they have with the bill that he mentioned on the podcast are at a scale enough and they're fundamental enough to the bill that it could basically significantly slow it down or even alter the intent of it. And that is not at all what Willie Jackson, the broadcasting minister, wants. So what happened after I recorded yesterday was these three big beats. Firstly, the submissions on the bill became public. Sometime yesterday afternoon, the 800 submissions that they have received, including one from the Spinoff, all went live on the Parliament website. And if you look at, all of the big media companies submitted on it, as you would expect with something that is this profound and consequential to this industry. And it is really, really shocking the extent to which they say essentially the same thing. The first being, we support the idea of a merger. The second being, this thing has got no clarity around how it will behave commercially. And until it has some clarity, there is a grave danger of it absolutely smashing the private sector media. And, if that's your intention, cool, but that doesn't seem to be what you're aiming to achieve here. Why are they so concerned? Basically, because you know TVNZ is already probably the best commercial operator in the industry. You know, it makes over $300 million a year, almost all of it in advertising revenue. Post-merger, it will have that plus the $40 million a year that funds RNZ, plus $109 million a year more, to do whatever it wants with, effectively. And whatever it wants could be some combination of buying a bunch of sports rights that will get people watching, watching its channels and watching its digital properties. Could be, you know, buying the best ideas for new shows out there and putting them on its platforms. Could be hiring awesome talent away from, you know, all of the other media companies in New Zealand. It could be offering commercial prices that are just a bit cheaper than everyone else because they only really need to make 70 cents in the dollar as a not-for-profit with a big subsidy to survive. And any one of those would be a problem for the private sector media, but all of them could really, really sort of shut some people down, could just radically diminish what's already like, you know, everyone knows that the number of journalists employed is halved, the audiences are going south. You have a massive new state-funded competitor with that kind of ballast around it, and it's going to be a problem. So that's basically what all of the submissions sketched out. And so that was the first big shoe to drop. You know, there was, I think we all knew that there would be issues with the bill from the private sector media. What we didn't know was just the absolute unanimity and scale of the concerns expressed. And while that's on some level the point of a bill, it's in draft form. They hear the submissions, they potentially evolve it, and then it gets better and it passes. There's just not a huge amount of time before, you know, March 31 when this thing is supposed to happen, and January or so when it's supposed to pass for all of that to be folded in the bill, given the complexity of the issues raised. That was the first thing to happen. The next, and this was kind of, this is small and petty. I wrote a piece about this that you can read on the spin-off, but I basically described this as like, you know, being removed from the chat ahead of a party. But what happened was that on Monday, we've got a public holiday. You might even be listening to this on that public holiday rather than remembering the Queen like you're meant to. How dare you? But we're going to have a big memorial service for the Queen, you know, because I guess you have to do that. And you would expect, given all of the energy that is going into merging these entities, that the natural broadcast of that would be TVNZ and RNZ. That's what you'd expect. But the broadcasters are RNZ, yes, but the other broadcaster is 3, not TVNZ. A source that I've spoken to at 3 said that that was actually a request that came from government. And it's on some level completely petty, but it's also instructive about the current state of the relationship between TVNZ and government, that they're really not getting on. So that was a little signal, and then bang, Willie Jackson comes out with, making some comments about the kind of current state of the relationship between RNZ and TVNZ and the government. And you know, this I'm quoting here. He said that the merger was going to require a change of culture, particularly from TVNZ. Not so much RNZ, because I think they get the model. And then about TVNZ, he said, we've had a couple of meetings with them, and I think they want the best of all worlds at the moment, but we need them to change their attitude. And that, yeah, that's pretty strong. You know, this is the minister who's ultimately in charge of both of those entities and who is now in charge of driving this merger through to its conclusion. And it really says that this, you know, what has previously been a bit of a kind of behind closed doors tension between TVNZ and the Crown is very much now out in the open. And you know, Willie Jackson is a former trade unionist. Like that is really in his bones, is, you know, pushing against the immovable object of a corporation and kind of bending it to the will of what he sees as his constituency. And, you know, this yeah, that's what he lives for. That's where he comes from. So he will, on some level, be enjoying this. He's certainly very experienced at this kind of an interaction. So there is a school of thought that TVNZ, this brilliant commercial operator that has actually made a very good digital transition. TVNZ Plus is a great product. It's growing very fast. You know, part of TVNZ, you can forgive them for thinking, well, we're already doing this stuff. I don't really know why. You know, if you wanted to give us more money to do more things, great, but we're not broken. Don't try and fix us. Obviously, the government has a different perspective. It thinks that TVNZ is too commercially dominated, that it needs to have more of the kind of public media ethos that's in RNZ. What this episode at its broadest kind of now says is that where it might have been assumed that TVNZ would be the biggest kind of part of this merger, that it's got more people, more money, it's a bigger, more famous brand, that actually the sort of public service, public media ethos, the non-commercial ethos of RNZ under Paul Thompson is favoured by the government. And whether it's Thompson who leads it or not, whether he even wants to, I'm not sure. Got a request in for him to come on this podcast when he returns from an overseas trip. But that their culture, that their ethos will be dominant and commercial will be kept in a box. How that works practically, honestly, that's a very difficult one to figure out. But that is the intention, and it's with time and diligence and smart people, I'm sure it can be figured out. The thing that's really interesting about where we're at now is that there is a bit of a foot race to do this. That this is, next year is an election year. This thing is supposed to happen by March 31. There really is a lot to do, and that's every chance. It's a very competitive race according to polling now. National basically said if the merger has happened, then we'll let it be. If it hasn't, we won't push it through ourselves. I think that's the most recent position, but obviously these things can evolve as well. So it can't really slip, and a lot of things do, like it's a difficult environment to operate in coming out of COVID. This is complicated policy. That merger, which has been up until now just kind of moving along quite quietly, publicly expressed enthusiasm from most parties, privately expressed angst is now, it's out there. It's a lot more of a kind of chaotic energy around it than there had been to this point. And it feels like the select committee, which is going to hear oral submissions on the bill over the next couple of weeks, those select committee hearings are going to be pretty damned interesting. The ultimate aim of all this is to create a new media entity or use the channels of the existing ones or the talent to reach audiences which don't currently get well served by our media. That's actually a noble ambition. Like, that's a really important thing. It almost comes down to your sort of, social license to operate, that if you're going to tax a bunch of people and then make a product for them, that they all should have a part of it that's made for them, that they access, that they enjoy and appreciate. And right now, that's just not really, that's not nearly so true of younger and more diverse communities than it is for older Pākehā audiences with TVNZ and RNZ. And that's not particularly a criticism of either of them. It's just that they come from linear television and radio as the core of what they do. They still have to do that. And they haven't had massive increases in funding, and that's just not what those younger and more diverse audiences are doing with their eyes and ears. So it matters. This is the route the government's taken, is the merger. It could have given more money to New Zealand On Air and said it looks like that organisation is going to get a big funding cut. It's all a very large and complicated and profound change, the biggest that's happened in our state media for generations, and it's coming at us very fast and it suddenly got very contentious. So I'll keep addressing that on this show. But there's a lot going on. I can't lie. I am kind of excited by it, but I also recognize that it's not just about the excitement of it, you know, which I can, as a sort of a dude who kind of observes the media very closely, this is actually really, really important work too. So it's important we get it right. So the state of social media, I think we've lived through a very long period where social media kind of felt like it was, on some level, it was fairly fixed. You had Facebook, Big Blue, as you know, the most dominant thing, maybe not the most loved, but something that basically everyone had to use. You had Instagram, which grew very fast to become the picture thing, and sort of cannily stole from Snapchat to get a bit of video in there, and that felt like it was a sort of a clear second place. You had YouTube, which did, you know, is it social media? It's kind of it's a bit edge casey. It's got user-generated content, but by far the majority of users just use it to watch. Some will interact with that content more than others, but they were the dominant for sort of horizontal video and still a massively successful and important part of the system. You had Twitter, which is basically a sort of a niche community takes machine. And then, you know, there was the likes of WhatsApp and Messenger and so on. But I almost think those are kind of category differences. They're more kind of giant messaging than public-facing social media. So, you know, that sort of system seemed to hold for a relatively long period of time. And then TikTok comes along and feels like it has just blown up everything. It's become such an attention monster. You know, there are a lot of stats over the last year or so that suggest, you know, in terms of time spent, in terms of data consumed, that it might have been the biggest thing on the internet last year for something that basically didn't exist in 2018. I don't think we can talk about that enough. Certainly we should talk about it more than the freaking Queen's funeral. And obviously this is tremendously challenging to Mark Zuckerberg. Look, in part, it kind of proves a thesis that they've had all along, which is that, yes, we own a massive part of the market, but, you know, we shouldn't be considered monopolies. And, you know, the sort of antitrust drums that are beating about us, you know, they're misplaced because we're vulnerable. And so it's proved, you know, like let's be honest, but and their share price reflects that. But also, you know, I think that there is, with each of these new discoveries, they're almost unique creations unto themselves. And as much as they try and copy elements of what they do, people use them in different ways and want different things from them. And that has been, you know, I think the big lesson of this is there is a tension between what the business goals of a Facebook are and what, or a Meta are, and what people like using those platforms for, and, you know, how it should respond to what the audience is showing, like the revealed intention of its behavior on other platforms, versus whether the existing Facebook audience actually wants it to move into being basically TikTok by any other name. Either way, it's happening because Mark Zuckerberg remains the controlling shareholder of Meta, and I may have mentioned this on the pod before, I think it's really important to understand what an absolute obsessive student of classics Zuckerberg was. And, you know, if you read books about Facebook, it's a real present thought of his, that he basically has this kind of wartime general persona that he puts on when he perceives threat or opportunity, and he will kind of bend the whole company to his will. It's not impressive, you know, what he accomplishes, but it's also kind of scary given that he's the unelected boss of so much of our attention. So one element of that is this huge bet on the metaverse that he's made, which, man, I mean, it's a massive bet. It's billions of dollars. I still don't necessarily believe it, but, you know, much smarter people than me do, so we'll see how that plays out. The other side of it is, in terms of his existing infrastructure, it is taking what is happening and really trying to learn from what TikTok has done, which is, you know, Facebook was and Instagram were really organized around what they call the social graph. So you followed people that were in your address book, basically, and maybe a few other sort of brands, and that became a very efficient marketing machine. TikTok's big insight was, we'll just show you entertaining content based on your revealed preferences, just by serving you lots and lots of short form things and learning very fast what that tells us about you. And Facebook said, look, they're right. That is a better way of going about things. And so both in terms of the short form vertical video and content from anywhere that our our big data processing shows us what you like, we're going to move first Instagram and then Facebook towards that. That is not a small thing. Like, that's massive. And you saw that with Instagram, where they basically just started doing it. They started doing it in a way that users didn't really like. You know, there was that whole Kardashian make Instagram Instagram again thing. They ended up walking back a bit from it while also saying, we're going to do this. We just recognize that our algorithm isn't that good yet. There's also, like, you know, lots of weird anti-competitive stuff. I went to this event not so long ago that was run by Instagram, and they wouldn't even say the words TikTok. They would just constantly talk about some other competitors have a watermark. If you upload your content with a watermark, the algorithm will downrank it. So they're encouraging people to create original content for their platform in a way that, honestly, if there was a functioning, not a functioning commerce commission, but if this stuff was properly regulated, all of this would be seen as kind of anti-competitive. And anyway, we don't regulate social media. It's probably, to my mind, the signal policy failure of our time, and basically half the bad stuff in the world is attributable to it, but that's by the by. The point is that these companies are just desperately trying to copy TikTok. It almost doesn't matter what the audience wants. They're that terrified. But TikTok is just winning. It's winning a kind of a brand war. It just feels cooler. It's currently hiring its first New Zealand staff. Like, because right now, all it has is attention. It's going to become masses and masses of money. And that money will be, yeah, obviously, all money spent in New Zealand comes from a big pool that represents every dollar. And every year, there's less spent on, you know, boring old New Zealand media that employs people here, and more spent on, you know, these platforms. That's a discussion for another time. But the point is that it will come away from Facebook's, from Meta's companies and go towards TikTok. That just feels like an inevitability. And, you know, that is ultimately the sort of rear guard that Zuckerberg is trying to fight right now. The thing which I think has been underrated in all this is the impact on the rest of New Zealand's media. Like, when Facebook first walked into the room, it said, we are a place for sharing. And it encouraged, you know, lots of organizations, brands, creators, traditional media, digital media, to set up shop there, to rely on it for, you know, a particular relationship with its audience. It said, spend a lot of money here building that audience and speaking to that audience. It's, you know, this is what we are for. And so we all did that and built up audiences. You know, we've got about 130,000 odd followers there, RNZ about 280,000, all the way up to the Herald with about 1.3 million or so. And we did that on the basis that we would create news content, we would put it in feeds. This was a for our audiences. This was a cool way to use Facebook. I can see what Auntie Jane's up to, but I can also catch up with the news. And, you know, there was a good value exchange there. Our content made their thing more professional. They could sell ads around it. We got some audience from it. And obviously there is a, you know, precisely how much value exchange there is up for debate. In fact, it's currently before the Commerce Commission. I won't address that. But the point is that was the fundamental idea of what Facebook was for its audience. And lately, Facebook has literally explicitly told us, like people, you know, my good friends who work there, Facebook is not for that anymore. We're not going to be a place where you can share links and expect traffic to come. And you're going, I remember them telling me, and I was like, yeah, that seems interesting, but, you know, I'm busy. And then the more I sat with it, I was like, oh, that's kind of the biggest thing to happen to our industry since Facebook came along, because link sharing through the biggest platform there is enormous. Like that is a huge part of our traffic. It's a huge part of all traffic. It's virality of stories versus, so this, you know, as an audience member, you can go to a news platform and read stories. That's important. But a huge part of the sort of spiky traffic is through viral stories, which go on Facebook, and, you know, for whatever reason, they have this kinetic quality that makes them spread. That quality, you know, drives the news. I think it's important. You know, we would have our core audience that come to our platform, but there's a second audience, which is also core, but just behaves differently, that is used to, that understands, I read the spin-off through Facebook, and that's how they've done it for years. Facebook has changed that. Like in recent, it's weeks, we have seen our traffic through Facebook and our engagement metrics on Facebook plummet, like halve. And we're not alone in that. This has been made a little bit noisy by the Queen's death, which I'll talk about shortly, but there are other major media platforms, most notably RNZ, which have also seen their engagement rates plummet. Engagement rates are a pretty good proxy for traffic. So this isn't catastrophic. We used to be way more reliant on Facebook traffic than we are, and our core audience come to us anyway. In fact, our homepage views are trending up, because I think some people are starting to sense, oh, I haven't seen much from the spinoff there in a while, and I'm sure I am seeing a lot of kind of short-form vertical video content here. The point is, Facebook just hasn't told this story publicly, and I think that is quite disingenuous. Like, it's very important for people who have, because you told them to, relied on your platform to get news and information, if you're going to stop doing that, you should say so. Like, that should be your biggest comms goal for 6 months. We've got a local election on. You know, there are anti-vaccine candidates standing right now. Stuff has done a fantastic job in uncovering some of that. Like, this is just, it just could not be more important. And I just think it's beyond cynical to make such a profound change in terms of how your product's operating, the type of content it's serving, and not do a massive public-facing campaign about that it's happening and why it's happening. Because we rely on it for so much more. And we saw in Australia when they just turned off news, they also turned off cyclone warnings and, you know, public health warnings during a pandemic. It was a massive deal. And when you think about that happening slowly, about all of the, you know, thousands of government comms people that still rely primarily on Facebook to do their job, that stuff's going away too. There's just so much in it that I think should be made public, and I just think that we aren't thinking and talking about it enough. So I figure with my podcast, if I do that, that's the job done. No, look, I'll try and write about it some more, but ultimately this is a much, much bigger discussion than me. I just hope that government and media and regulators and all the people who are interested parties to this, that's basically everyone, start to pay more attention to this storyline. The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Lastly, and this is somehow relevant, I think I had more of a through line. I want to talk about the Queen and the coverage of the Queen. Why is it relevant to this? I mean, on some level, it's just a one-time content bomb. You know, we're not really talking about the institution of monarchy, whether we should have a republic, all of that stuff here. Look, that's, as they say, a discussion for another day or at least another forum. I'm really talking about the volume of coverage and where that coverage was distributed. You know, by and large, you'd say that the older your audience is, the more absolute, like full throttle you've gone with Queen is Dead coverage. We, on day one, you know, it was an enormous event. It came to some extent out of a clear blue sky. We responded, you know, I, again, super biased, but I was really proud of our editorial team, the way they stepped up, the way they wrote, the way they commissioned, and the way that we've continued to kind of analyze it from, you know, Tara and Alex live blogging the funeral with the sense of humor, but also of occasion, to Anarafti Connell writing about the sort of meme side of the Queen, to Morgan Godfrey kind of writing about her as an ariki, and you know, and all of and everything in between. But I guess the point is that stuff didn't really rate for us. You know, like I was on some level prouder of our audience for not being overly fussed by this situation. They sort of, it was a news story, people like to read about it, but our traffic, our site didn't sort of buckle and flex under the weight of interest. Now, that clearly wasn't the case with the rest of the media. You know, we had the funeral streamed live on both One and Three. We had, you know, bumping their very high rating content. We've had the kind of key reporters shipped to London to basically stand next to a queue. I must recommend Hayden Donnell's Midweek Media Watch from last week, where he kind of recapped a lot of the absurdity of that in a very entertaining style. We had, I think the apex of it was Morning Report, which is probably the New Zealand media product I consume the most. I love it. It frustrates me. But it really, like, I couldn't kind of really believe it. But on Tuesday, the day after the Queen's funeral, there were 15 separate items outside of their scheduled, you know, rural news, business updates, so on. And only one of them was not about the Queen, and that one was about Jacinda Ardern flying to New York. So there's definitely some Queen content in that. And I just think this was the day after the Effendel report was released. We can talk about the cynicism of that timing, sure, agree. But you know, as news editors, we should basically be able to kind of treat something with the importance that it deserves, but also not completely lose our heads over it. And the sheer volume of coverage is basically indicative that it is rating. You know, we understand our relationship with our audience. So the reason that the news sites, newspapers, et cetera, kind of stayed with us is because audiences were sort of lapping it up. And I just think that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do at this moment. And I'll sort of tell you why. And I think it's because, you know, I've been writing a little bit for Lucy Blackiston's Shit You Should Care About newsletter about the monoculture, about that period when we all had to watch a relatively narrow number of channels, stations, magazines, newspapers. So we kind of had this common cultural language. We knew who the same celebrities were, et cetera. And the royal family is the ultimate version of that. You just knew so much about them just by existing. You couldn't avoid it. And that's for people, you know, my age. I'm 42. My age on up, that's particularly so. And that's why, and I think the older you are, the more monocultural your life has been, the more the royal family is just this constant, the queen, just the biggest celebrity in the world in some respects. And so I understand, like, that's why the coverage. But it also feels like for people, say, younger than, say, 35, 30, this is just bizarre. And I also think it's alienating. So if you are creating these products with an eye on not just your kind of core audience, but also on your future audience and how you sort of are perceived, having saturation coverage of the Queen's death, while it's great for the base, you know, you've got to win over these sort of marginal newcomers. And I think it makes us look, as an industry, completely out of touch with, you know, proportionality and what else is going on in the world. Like, Vladimir Putin's walking around there with a nuclear missile launcher, and we just are interviewing people about their corgis. And I just think, I'm not saying it wasn't a big deal. I'm not saying it shouldn't have dominated the sort of the coverage on Monday and Tuesday. I do think, though, that it was way overboard. And I worry a little bit, as we're about to merge TVNZ and RNZ, the fact that both of them were just wall to wall, it means that the job is harder. The job of attracting new audiences and making the case to them that you understand them and their interests. And look, this has never been harder than before, because before you didn't have any choice. So you could just pander to this. You'd have done this 20 years ago, consequence-free. We probably all get into it. But now they can tune out. And when they tune out, they're tuning into TikTok. That's really good. It's just really, really good. And if you don't like the Queen, the algorithm will not show you the Queen. And that's the sort of... And then how do you claw them back? I mean, you can say, oh, well, it doesn't matter. It's just they're just choosing their own culture. But I think it matters. I think the fact that TikTok will show you content from anywhere in the world and doesn't necessarily and naturally serve you content from this country, it can lead to a bit of a disengagement with it. Next year, we've got a general election. It'd be quite nice if some young people voted in it. They've got a much greater degree of future time investment that they have to spend in this place. We as media sometimes have to act against our immediate financial, editorial, metrics-based interests to keep the people that we want, the audiences that we want, engaged. And I just think that we basically just gave in to the, you know, that we got that one last hit of monocultural power, and it's a bit at what cost? Because what I'll be watching, you know, everyone had a bump last week in terms of their CrowdTangle numbers. These are the sort of Facebook engagement stats. Started looking like it was May 22 all over again. But I think that when that fades, you know, absent some other big news bomb, when we get back to just boring old normal service, I just worry that not only will the stats continue to trend down, but those younger audiences that we sort of alienated by being just Queen Mania 24/7, that they will not come back. And that's a problem for all of us. So, it's a bit of a dangerous game. Anyway, still love the media. Still love all the New Zealand media. Just think we just did something a bit bizarre. But that's okay. We'll get through it. Thank you for listening. Really appreciate you all indulging me, the occasional monopod. Really appreciate Te Ahia Butler editing this thing, and Jane letting me do it, and all my colleagues at the spin-off making my job fun. One thing, if you're still around, I love you. Can you please give me a little rating on Apple Podcast or Spotify? Had a few bad ratings. It's got me down to a 4.6. Feel like some people are looking at me when when making that decision, going, maybe this is a ranked podcast. Maybe it is. Maybe that's a fair reflection, but I just would love to bump it up. So could you go and give me 5 stars? Jesus Christ, what's wrong with me? All right, that's me. That was The Fold. Ka kite anō.
The Fold was brought to you by the Spin-off Podcast Network. It was hosted by Duncan Grieve, produced by Tiahe Butler, with production management by Rachel Naru and series production by Jane Yee.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-off Podcast Network.